We are about to speak with another Georgia mom who has experienced the unimaginable. Join us today on Fostering the Future.
Welcome to the Fostering the Future podcast, a show about all things child welfare, dependency, adoption, and foster care. Here are your hosts, veterans in the world of child welfare, Jack and Kat.
We believe that every human has incredible and equal value regardless of what side of the courtroom we sit on. We hope that everyone feels welcome and accepted here on Fostering the Future.
Make sure you follow us on Facebook or Instagram as Fostering the Future Podcast, or check us out on our website at fosteringthefuturepodcast.org. Please join us as we continue with Diana's story.
So my son gets there. He's down in the ER about 8 p.m. They run all the same tests on him and he's fine. There's nothing wrong with him. And we're done with everything about 10:30 p.m. that night.
So they ran the test. Everything checked out fine with your son. Then did he come up to the room?
At 10:30, we were all done. And that's when the CPS worker came in and started questioning me about the events. What happened? And same thing, same chain of events. Well, we were out all day yesterday, Dave and Buster's. My husband said she was strapped in improperly in the car seat. And that was pretty much it. We woke up at 3 to 4 a.m., brought her to the emergency room. I thought we were done. I'm like, okay, now we can go upstairs. Well, I kept asking the nurse, oh, no, not yet, not yet. So it was 12:30 at that point. And finally, I said, what's the holdup? I'm going to go upstairs to my husband and my daughter. Give us a few more minutes. They're getting everything ready. My son is exhausted. Well, we don't have a room ready yet. We're going into my daughter's room. What are you talking about? 3 o'clock comes around. I call my husband's cell phone. He's asleep in my daughter's room. I am hysterical again, saying, I don't know what's happening. I feel like I'm being held hostage in this room. Christian's exhausted. I'm coming upstairs. So he's like, all right, I'm going to the nurse's station. I'll figure this out. Within 20 minutes or so, I get a call. Okay, come upstairs. So a nurse escorts me upstairs. And they escort me to a different room. But wait a minute, why are you putting me in a different room? You said that twins should never be separated. You brought a pack and play. I'm going in there with my daughter. No, we can't allow that. The kids have to be separate. And that was it. Like, there was no further explanation. They tried to say it was against company policy, but they would not allow the twins in the same room. Therefore, the parents had to be separated as well, because one parent had to stay with one child. I was too exhausted to argue with them at that point. At that point, I'd been up for 24 hours. Finally got my son settled. It was 3:30, almost 4 in the morning. I lay there on the couch, and by 6 a.m., the nurses start coming in. I go check on Amelia, and then the questioning starts happening all over again. We were questioned by two different people, I'm guessing from the same organization on the chain of events. So we just kept repeating ourselves the same thing over and over, what happened. And of course, they didn't have answers for us. They're just documenting. They take my husband out for questioning. That's when I'm introduced to the child protective team. When a group of doctors walked into the room, but the only one that spoke to me and introduced herself was Dr. Barbara Knox. And she introduced herself as the head of the child protective team.
Barbara Knox has just entered the scene.
Dr. Knox was the only one that introduced herself out of the team. It was normal questioning at first with her. You're a new mom. Yes. Do you ever feel stressed out? Not really. Do you take time out for yourself? I kind of chuckled at that one. I was like, well, what do you mean? Like, I don't get manicures or pedicures. I'm a mom of three right now. She asked me like what the daily routine looked like. I said, well, we're just now getting into the swing of things. I said, this week has been a really good week of getting into a routine where we're out and about and having play dates and I said, but the first week my husband was back at work was kind of very scheduled. It was babies are awake, babies eat, then I have to pump, then the baby's back to sleep, you know, and that's kind of how it was every 2 to 3 hours. So it's either feeding babies, changing babies, putting babies to bed. You know, essentially I lived on the couch for a minute. And then the line of questioning drastically changed. It just didn't feel right. She said, well, I'm about to tell you some things that you're not going to want to hear. She like touched my knee and then said, I know you don't want to hear this, but your daughter has a grade 3 liver laceration and it's bleeding internally. I looked at her and said, what are you talking about? And she goes, again, I know this must be hard for you to hear. And I said, is she going into surgery right now? Oh, I don't know. I don't know. I'll find out. I said, how old is this laceration? Again, I said, could this have happened in NICU? She said, oh, I don't know. There's no way to tell. I said, can I see it? Can I see this CAT scan that shows you a grade 3 liver laceration? You're telling me my daughter is bleeding internally. Oh, yeah, I'll go ask the radiologist and I'll be back. But again, she touched my leg and said, in my 30 years of experience, the only way I have ever seen this type of injury, and she demonstrated it. She acted like she was holding a baby in one hand and said, either a baby was held and punched repeatedly in the abdomen. And I can't even bring myself to do that motion like she was doing, demonstrating it to me. Or the baby was drop kicked across the room. Again, I just looked at her and said, what are you talking about? I said, how can an 8-pound baby be punched repeatedly in the abdomen? I said, she hasn't shown any signs of pain or discomfort. She doesn't have any bruises on her. She couldn't give me any answers. And I was like, you're telling me that someone kicked my baby across a room? I'm like, so do you think this happened in NICU? Because now my mind is spiraling, thinking, oh my God, did someone hurt my baby when I didn't see them when she was in NICU? But then I kept going back to the same thing. I said, she doesn't have any marks on her. How is that possible? I said, she hasn't shown any signs of pain or discomfort. For her to be so sure of herself and her scenarios and to come up with such vile reenactments, it's just traumatizing. It's just, I can't understand why a doctor would do that. You're coming up with this crazy scenario that my 8-pound baby was punched repeatedly in the abdomen. I didn't even know what a drop kick was. I had to like look it up later. And I said, how does she not have any physical anything? Like, there's not one mark on my baby's body. And again, I just said, please, I need to see this CAT scan. Please go ask if she's having surgery. And she said, absolutely, I'll go ask right now. And I never saw that woman again. I never saw a CAT scan. They never showed me this supposed liver laceration. And my baby was not bleeding internally.
I don't understand how that makes sense. When you have problems with your liver, you're doubled over, you're screaming. Like, how is she not reacting? Like someone who has a laceration such that she's bleeding. Like, that doesn't make sense. And what I don't understand is, even if she really believed this happened and that somebody, like, I don't know if she thought like a daycare worker or she really thought you did these things, why she would act it out in front of you to have you already going through what you're going through with having a child with some form of medical concern, because you know you didn't do it and you know there's something obviously wrong and you're trying to find answers. And then she's accusing you of letting someone do this to your child. So I would be thinking in my head, like, in what moments of my child's life have they not been with me? Like, she wasn't in daycare or anything, right?
Yeah, no, she wasn't. And that's why I kept asking repeatedly. I said, could this have happened in NICU? Can you tell me how old this is? But she literally said, oh, I don't know. I'm going to go talk to the radiologist. When I asked if she's going to have surgery, oh, I don't know. I'm going to go talk to so-and-so.
They've still not shown proof of the liver laceration?
The radiologist report states irregular regions noted within the right lobe, some of which are close to the dome of the liver, which are concerning for contusions or lacerations. No fluid or hemorrhage seen. That's what it said.
No fluid or hemorrhage means there was no internal bleeding. That document shows they lied.
The other person that we talked to from Wolfson, they also told her there was a laceration of the liver.
Why walk in my room with such a vile, detailed story and then try to rub my knee? You're going to console me first and then go into this very detailed reenactment of what happened to my 8-pound babies laying next to me.
It's sadistic.
Yeah.
Someone punching an 8-pound baby repeatedly in the abdomen or kicking her across the room. She's 8 pounds. She can't hold her head up yet. In my mind, that would kill her.
Right. And she would be covered in bruises.
And massive internal bleeding. Massive.
She came up with more very descriptive scenarios on how her rib injuries happened. They said that she had CML fractures in her wrist and ankles as well.
She gave you descriptions of how those happened?
Not to me, but she did on the stand in her testimony. Because I didn't know about those injuries, because those injuries were documented after we were removed from the hospital. She went to the radiologist and they did an addendum.
So what happened between the time that she came into the room and had that conversation with you? What happened next?
She never came back. Nurses came in. They had never gotten a line in. So they actually had to have someone come in with an ultrasound and like ultrasound as they tried to get the line in, holding her down yet again. I asked the nurses if she was having surgery. They just looked at me like I was crazy. Like, what are you talking about? Because like, yes, that was just never even a realm of possibility. The nurses were really sweet, you know, reassuring, saying, this is just normal protocol. You know, you guys seem like really sweet people. One nurse even said, oh, you know what? Don't worry about it. I had a friend that this same thing happened to her. Just go through the motions. Everything's going to be fine. You know, and I'm like, okay, because obviously, like I said, they're not trying to figure out what's wrong with my child. The day goes on. They keep drawing labs. We don't really hear from anybody because we've already been questioned, I think, maybe 3 or 4 times at that point. My husband goes out and gets us dinner. And I am breastfeeding Amelia. The same CPS worker that had questioned me the night before in the emergency room with Christian then comes in with an armed security officer, a male, says, you're being removed from the hospital and your children are being taken into state custody. And I don't get to hand my baby over to her. She physically rips her out of my arms while I'm feeding her. And she tells me to gather my belongings and that I need to be escorted out. I was just scrambling. I was hysterical. I asked if I could say bye to my son. And I was just told that I had to leave. I grabbed what I could see around me. We left half of our things. And I was being escorted out by an armed security officer. I just remember crying out so loudly through the hallway that people started to come out of their rooms to see what was going on. My husband met me in the parking garage because they had already stopped him from coming back into the hospital. That was on October 2nd in that evening. So in a little over 24 hours, our kids were taken, all 3 of them. When we didn't get any questions answered, I don't even know what tests had even been run at that point.
And they wouldn't give you any of the x-rays or medical records, despite the fact that you are a parent with parental rights and every right to your children's medical records.
I did not see one. So they essentially removed us before running all of their tests, because it turns out they ran for the 2 most common forms of OI and some blood work. And that's all they did.
So they ran tests for the 2 most common forms of OI, OI being osteogenesis imperfecta. Aren't there hundreds of tests that you have to run to completely rule out OI?
There are several different conditions that can contribute to bone fragility, even outside of osteogenesis imperfecta. There are other states that now have laws where they have to do adequate genetic testing, not just for OI, but Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, metabolic bone disorders, do a DEXA scan to look at their bone density. All of these things have to be ruled out before non-accidental trauma or abuse can be ruled. But the geneticist that they called upon, again, from UF Health, called to get our family history. I believe it was on the 3rd, so the day after. And we're telling them all of our family history, anything we could possibly think of. Again, you're in a traumatic state, so you're still trying to think of everything that you can think of in your family history. They don't ask me about fractures. They ask about osteoporosis. We tell them that it runs on my side of the family, on the female side, at a very early age. They document our history wrong. Like, they called my husband's brother the father of Amelia, the age range that I told them that my aunts and my mom were diagnosed with osteoporosis. They were in their late 20s to early 30s. They documented that it was 50 to 60s. Arthritis, all these things that ran in the family, it was just documented improperly. And then she concluded our family history. The only thing that qualified was the two most common forms of OI. And that's what she tested for. All of these specialists are being brought in from UF Health. I really don't know the correlation there.
So UF Health Jacksonville is where the child abuse pediatricians are.
Dr. Knox is employed by UF Health. The geneticist that was called in, Dr. Trepain, also from UF Health. In Dr. Knox's report, it says that mother asked about metabolic bone disorders, genetic disorders, and it says to test Amelia for genetic disorders, and it says / EDS, or Ehlers-Danlos syndrome. But they still only chose to test her for the two most common forms of OI.
Which is interesting that she did that when she told you that none of those things could cause these injuries.
Right, which is also interesting. You're going to diagnose it's abuse before these tests are even run. Before you even get a conclusion on the test that you're ordering, you're going to call it abuse already.
And tell you that that's not even possible. If it wasn't possible, you wouldn't have run the tests. And if you think it's possible, you should have run all the tests.
Exactly. So the twins were staying at the hospital until they could figure out where they could go. And they actually called, they being Department of Family Children's Services in Camden County, called my sister and said, you can come get your sister's twins. And she's like, absolutely. And my sister was 3 hours away. She made it to Wolfson's at 11 p.m. And when she showed up, they said that she was not allowed to have them.
She drove 3 hours to get there after they said to come get them. And then when she got there, they said she couldn't have them. Okay.
And at that point, my mother already has my 3-year-old. So I guess they were like, well, why can't we take the twins to my mom's house? And no one would give us an answer. Me and my husband are at home, obviously not knowing where our twins are going to go. No one's giving us a straight answer. We're trying to rack our brains on what could have happened. Since no one could give us a timeline, we're then just scrambling at everything that we could possibly think of. Of course, we replay the day's events at Dave & Buster's, literally the day before, the baby being improperly strapped into the car seat. We said, well, did we stop anywhere? Yes, we stopped and got gas. Anything happened when we stopped and got gas? No. When we stopped to get gas, the line was really long. What my husband did, because he was driving, he would tap the brakes on and off to keep the car rocking, to keep the twins asleep. As soon as the car stopped moving, the twins would always wake up. You know, we're like, could that have done anything? So we're just kind of like going through anything we could think of. And then, of course, I think of the incident in NICU where Amelia was choking during a tube feeding and she had to have the Heimlich, or I guess now they like to call it back slaps, essentially, where she had to be turned over and her back stimulated. And when she was 22 days old, could that have caused injury? Just things like that. I mean, we were just racking our brains on anything that could have caused it. And of course, my brain just keeps going back to the pregnancy complications, her being growth restricted. Golly, how many times did we go into labor during that time? And she was so restricted and so low in my birth canal the entire time in the third trimester. After, of course, brainstorming, that's the first time we had met, I guess, our case manager. He had come to our house and we thought he was coming to the house to let us know that the twins can go to my mother's with my daughter. And he said the twins were not allowed to go with family, that they were to go to foster care because they needed specialized medical treatment and care. And I just looked at him and I said, what kind of specialized medical care do they need? And he said, they, because I'm like, well, you're speaking of Amelia. And he didn't give me an answer. That was, I think, my only question, what kind of specialized medical care? And at that point, I was just, again, hysterical. Now knowing that my babies were going to a stranger into foster care and like, you know, reality is setting in that my kids are being taken from me and they're going into a stranger's home. I didn't know who they were going to. I wasn't told who they were going to. I didn't ever meet her.
The thing about going into medical care, it implies that there is a medical diagnosis that would require that. Now, I don't know if Georgia is different from Florida, but in Florida, when you go into medical foster care, the insurance has to approve it. And there has to be a diagnosis substantial enough that a child needs long-term medical care. A little diagnosis doesn't cut it, and certainly not healing broken bones doesn't cut it. So for them to say that kind of implies that they believe that one or both of the children have a medical diagnosis requiring a specialized foster placement. So I'm confused at that, because what they have told you is that what is wrong with your child is something you or somebody did to her. But at the same time, they're telling you that she can't go to a family member because she has some type of medical diagnosis that would require a special placement. It's kind of contradictory, is what I'm saying.
It's very contradictory, but it's also very much not true. After getting a hold of her medical records, there were no special discharge instructions as far as specialized medical care, as he implied. Even though she was lovely, this foster mother didn't have any specialized medical training. She received instructions upon getting my children at the hospital. And those instructions were to pick Amelia up from underneath her bottom. That was it.
So obviously that's not something your relatives could handle.
Right. Yeah, they were not at the capacity to be given these instructions to pick a baby up from underneath her bottom.
That's a great reason to place a child with strangers.
She was not a medical foster home then.
Not at all. And then the only other instructions at that point were her vitamins were doubled. Her famotidine was doubled. And she came home in a pelvic harness. Even though they're claiming that both her wrists are broken, both her ankles are broken, she has all these rib fractures. Someone said that she came home in a full body cast. She didn't. She came home in a pelvic harness. And the only follow-up she had was for an x-ray done on October 16th to check on her healing, and one additional appointment with the orthopedic for her femur.
Is it possible that her wrist and were broken when they were trying to do the IVs?
That's my thought process. If there's any type of fractures in her wrist, that's the only thing I can think of, because they were physically holding her down, not delicately. And I watched them do it over and over again, both wrists. And then, like I said, at her ankle.
And then did they strap her in? If they were air flighting her, did they strap her in by her pelvis?
Yes.
So could she have gotten pelvic fractures by that? I mean, if they gave her a pelvic brace or whatever, were they saying there were pelvic straps?
She had multiple straps. She had a strap across her chest. And then I believe one, yes, you're right, down towards the like the bottom where her pelvis was.
Other families that we have spoken with that have had similar experiences to you go to the hospital. They're told that their children have all these fractures and they come home in like with no casts, with like in an ACE bandage. This is kind of like the same thing all over again. She has fractures all over her body, but she's only coming home in a pelvic harness. What about her broken femur? And do we know if they were actual fractures or if they might have even just been lesions?
So the way it was explained to us, the geneticist that we had looked at her x-rays and CAT scans, he did date a majority of them back to either in utero or NICU, except for obviously the femur. The femur, actually, when Dr. Pena testified against us, he said it was a re-break. I'm not sure how long it takes a femur to heal. I would think a little bit of time.
But that sounds like maybe something that happened in utero or in the NICU.
And then if she's strapped in improperly, on top of the 7 weeks of not having fortified formula to help with bone development and growth and healing, if she already had all these injuries, the way it was explained to us, and when he showed the x-rays, the geneticist that we had, because essentially what they were trying to say was every single tip of her rib was broken.
The tips of the rib?
The tips of the ribs.
Isn't that called cupping and indicative of a bone disease?
That's exactly what the doctor said, was that it's cupping and they're actually not fractures. And then he also said that a lot of the white stark lines that were seen in her bones were calcium being pulled. And he showed a perfect example of that with her spine. He showed a picture of her spine and it showed demineralization. Her spine was the same color as her flesh. It was gray. And normally your bones are white on an x-ray. And then he saw a double white line when you zoomed in on the vertebrae. And that was the calcium being pulled from her bone to regulate her body.
So all of these things are indicative of a bone disease.
Correct.
Your daughter Arabella was questioned by DFACS, right? After the removal or before the removal?
She was not questioned by DFAS. She was questioned by a forensic investigator for almost 2 hours. And I guess that was initiated by the GBI.
Georgia Bureau of Investigations. Was that in relation to the juvenile case? Or was there a criminal case at one point? They took a 3-year-old child and interviewed her for 2 hours by herself. Because when I heard this, I'm like, this is, and I'm sorry, like, I don't, if that's hard for you to talk about, you certainly don't have to talk about it.
And after doing research on what it was, it's not intended for children. That type of interrogation is not for a 3-year-old. And the fact that my daughter came out of that a completely different little girl, having panic attacks, saying that she's never going to see mommy and daddy again. I mean, I don't know what was said to her. I know they let her have a small break. And she came out into the lobby and my mom took her hand like they were going to leave. And the lady goes, oh, we're not done yet. Takes her hand and says, let's see what we can get out of you now. And I know when she came out of that room, she had such a severe panic attack that night going to sleep and saying that she was never going to be with mommy and daddy again. She was never going to see us again. And she's been having panic attacks ever since.
How is that legal?
That's what I don't understand. How can you interrogate a 3-year-old without anyone present or even her guardian ad litem, like her lawyer? I remember texting my lawyer being like, she's been back there 45 minutes. Is this normal? And she goes, no, not normally. But that means they're not getting what they want out of her.
A 3-year-old, you could give them candy and word something a certain way and they will tell you everything. So for them to push a child like that, they had to know that there's just not anything there. And to continue is actually about as sadistic as Barbara Knox. That's effing disgusting. I don't know how that was legal.
A little girl that's been ripped from her family. I mean, I work from home, so I've never left her side. And now you're sticking her in a room with strangers.
to be interrogated, and they're saying God knows what to her. I mean, so much so that it's causing her physical panic attacks where she tenses up her body, and my mom described it looking like a seizure. A three-year-old.
I don't think I've ever heard of somebody even questioning a three-year-old. Have you, Christy?
Only if there's like sexual abuse and they're doing a forensic interview.
And it certainly wouldn't be 2 hours.
No. Wow, that is horrific. I'm so sorry for all the things.
You said that there are no criminal charges currently. Were there ever criminal charges?
I believe it was our first day of adjudication. They issued a warrant for my husband's arrest. They did that during our lunch break. So he voluntarily turned that document.
And they did that during the adjudication hearing so they could ensure he was there. So they decided that he was the one that caused the harm and arrested him. They've dropped those charges.
No, we have not. And he doesn't have a hearing set in place for that.
So they just like leaving them over his head?
Yeah, they essentially just arrested him and we bonded him out. He has bond conditions. He hasn't been able to see Amelia since December. It's part of his condition. So I know that's tearing him up.
December, was that the adjudication hearing?
Yeah, the adjudication was, I want to say it was either 2 or 3 hearings long. It was pretty long because the state, like I said, had like 7 or 8 experts come against us. Out of all of the experts, I'm fairly confident Dr. Knox was the only one who testified that actually examined my daughter, actually physically saw her. Everyone else was just agreeing with the radiologist report, the ER doctor, and Dr. Knox's report. Every single one of them was questioned on the stand whether they looked at any of my prenatal history or complications. None of them looked at anything. They were all questioned whether they looked at all of her NICU records, and they all admitted that none of them looked at any of them except for her discharge lab work, and that was it.
At the adjudication, did they decide to give you a case plan? Were they trying to not reunify?
Yeah, we were never given any type of case plan. I'm just learning things now that I guess we should have had like a family team meeting with DFACS. I think approximately maybe 30 days after removal of our children. We didn't meet with DFACS until February. And that was after dependency was found, after the adjudication was done. We went through the adjudication hearings. Dr. Knox got up on the stand and vividly had more scenarios on now how her wrists and ankles and ribs were injured, decided to physically show the court with her hands, which again was appalling. I mean, and me having no medical training, it just didn't make any sense, because what she stated at that point on how these injuries occurred was she like loves to demonstrate. She said that my daughter was picked up around her rib cage, squeezed like a roll of paper towels from back to front, and then shook so violently that her wrist flailed forward, hit together, as well as her ankles flailed forward and hit together so violently that they broke.
That's incredibly hypothetical.
She had no trauma to her head.
Right. And again, we're talking about an 8-pound baby that can't even hold up.
No shaking baby.
No hemorrhaging behind her eyes. Nothing abnormal in her CAT scan of her head. No neck injuries. And again, an 8-pound baby that can't hold her own head up.
And people believed that garbage? A judge believed that. What kind of fools?
Every report says there's no bruising on my baby. I'm sure my face just looked bewildered in court because I'm just like, how? How in the world is anybody believing this? Because it's the size of a newborn. She's the size of a newborn baby. Like, just think about that. Like, it just logically, how does that make sense?
She would be more credible if she just said, these things might be abuse. I don't know what exactly was done, but these are the fractures. Like, that would be much more credible than this, because additionally, she's now saying that these rib fractures all happened at once with a paper towel crunch. But before, she said they had different levels of healing. So are we saying they happened at once? Are we saying they happened at various points in time.
Or she's saying that it happened on several different occasions, the same incident.
And here's the other thing that just blows me away with this case and with Shelby, who had similar absurd hypotheticals from the doctors. The child at this point has only been out of the hospital, in your case, for 7 weeks. They think this child was abused within this 7 week period so many different times that it created different levels of healing. But still, there's no scar, there's no bruise, there's no marks. How does that like logically make sense to anybody that they sign off? One person, okay, maybe one person's crazy and thinks that, but all these other people signed off on it for it to get to this point. Like, how do they do that? Like, is it just this crowd thought scenario where nobody wants to go against the grain? It's just absurd to me in these situations. Like, this is a small time period, 7 weeks. That this child is going to the doctor, being seen by doctors, being seen at the hospital, and none of these times in the 7 weeks, you don't have a single bruise, but there were so many different injuries that they're over a period of, like, that doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense.
I completely agree. Just like you stated, 16 days prior to the incident, she had a full physical exam. The doctor pushed all over her abdomen, all over her chest. Her arms, her legs. She didn't cry out in pain. She didn't show any discomfort. She didn't have any marks on her body. The pediatrician testified that she had no cause for concern. Just like you said, if you're going to speculate abuse, then just say these injuries could have occurred from abuse. But to get on the stand and be so detailed in your hypothetical scenario on how it happened, like that just, it just makes you wonder, for lack of better words, what is wrong with her?
Right. Let's talk about Dr. Knox.
So Dr. Barbara Knox, according to lots of news media, she was at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine. She had to resign her position there because...
Oh, why did she have to resign her position, Christy?
Because colleagues complained about unprofessional behavior and there were allegations from parents that she had wrongly accused them of child abuse. Imagine that.
In Wisconsin.
So that was in Wisconsin. So then in 2019, she took a new position in Alaska.
Wait, someone else hired her?
Someone else hired her. Can you believe that?
She had to go all
the
way to Alaska to get a job, though. I think it's cold there.
It is cold there. But she heated things up in Alaska. And January 28, 2022, she announced her resignation there as well, just days after the Anchorage Daily News and the Wisconsin Watch co-published the latest in a series of stories about families and caregivers who said their lives had been upended after Knox wrongfully diagnosed children's illnesses or accidental injuries as abuse. There were investigations in both of those places. There were, I believe, in Alaska, everybody who worked with her or for her resigned because of her behavior in the workplace.
What was she doing?
Intimidating coworkers to say that abuse was occurring, even if it wasn't. They reported her to the organization months prior. It fell on deaf ears. She resigned from there in Alaska. And guess who hired her? University of Florida, Jacksonville, as their assistant director of their fellowship program for their child abuse pediatricians. In Florida, we call it CPT doctors, child protection team.
She has had to resign from two positions for being investigated because she was removing children and calling it child abuse when it wasn't, as if that wasn't bad enough. To be bullying other doctors into doing the same is almost more dangerous, which means she can widen her reach.
Yeah. And she's in a leadership role in all three positions. So she's in a leadership role in Wisconsin, a leadership role in Alaska. And she comes down here and she's in a leadership role of a fellowship program that's training other child protection physicians.
That's terrifying.
It's unbelievable that these people are getting away with this. These child abuse pediatricians, they have to go.
They need to be held accountable.
The unchecked abuse of power, total and complete power.
To destroy families.
And the judges are letting them do it.
Thank you so much for joining us today. Make sure you subscribe and follow us on social. We hope that you join us again next time and keep on fostering the future.